From the World Newsroom in Boston, it's the Tech Podcast, number 126. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. Jason Margolis here in the cozy confines of the World Studios. This week's tech podcast, a little shorter than what we've been doing in the past few weeks, but it's quality, not quantity, quality. On the show today, a suite of stories about, you guessed it, climate change. Some more ominous predictions, but not all gloom and doom. A few pieces on some steps being taken to stem the tide. And a story about turning ammunition into... yes, coffee machines. That being done in Ethiopia. But first, a call for help from you. Every Monday, we have our editorial meeting. Actually, it's not really that dramatic. It's not dramatic at all. I just wanted the opportunity to use some more music from Mobius Operandi in San Francisco. They sent me a new disc, and this is really the only chance I had in the show. And cut the music. Thanks, guys. Thank you, Avi Rose, for sending the music. Back to the editorial meeting. Each week, the reporters and the show producers here in Boston, we sit around a big round table and we discuss the stories we're working on, what we want to do, just stuff like that. When I was up in Canada recently, I heard about, I picked up the accent apparently, I heard about some Canadian pastors and reverends who were podcasting their sermons to people who couldn't make it into church for this reason or that reason. And I think it's a really interesting story. So the producer of The World, the esteemed Andrew Sussman, who is an amazing boss. He's a genius. He's a news genius. And I'm not just saying that because I'm sucking up. That's objective reporting. Anyway, Andrew suggested doing an expanded piece, a look at all the different diverse podcasts from around the world. Really cool idea. So I started to do a little hunting and pecking, looking for some nuggets for some podcasts from different remote corners of the world. But then I thought, wait, I have this amazing resource. You, the listeners. So if there's a podcast you really like, can you do me a favor and drop me a quick email and let me know what it is, where it's from, and how you access it? One caveat, though. While I'm sure there are lots of great American podcasts that I'm missing out on, for this story, I'm not interested. Please only send me non-American podcasts, please. My email address is jason.margolis@bbc.co.uk. That is spelled jason.margolis@bbc.co.uk. Alrighty, on to the stories this week. Here's a series of stories, a suite of stories that ran on our program this week, and I'm going to let it play in its entirety as it did on our program.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. There are two major reports out today on climate change. Both paint a bleak picture of the challenges ahead. First, there's this finding from the United Nations. The countries that committed themselves to reducing their emissions of climate-changing greenhouse gases under the treaty known as the Kyoto Protocol are falling behind in the effort. And the United States, which has not ratified the treaty and is already the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, has seen its emissions continue to grow. And then there's this from a report that was commissioned by the British government. If the world doesn't take drastic measures to combat global warming, and quickly, the economic effects will be devastating, on par with the cost of two world wars and the Great Depression combined. John Holdren is president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He's an expert on climate policy and is director of the Woods Hole Research Center in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. The report out of Britain today, Dr. Holdren, puts the potential cost of climate change at $7 trillion if the world doesn't take action within the next 10 years. I don't know if you agree with that particular figure or not, but do you think it's in the ballpark, and what kind of disruptions are we talking about?
Nobody can predict with any certainty exactly what the economic costs of climate change damages are going to be, but I think this report has done as good a job of it as can be done at the current state of knowledge. And what I would say about the consequences is that they could easily be as large or larger.
And so what does it mean when we say, for instance, and this isn't your quote, this is from the British report itself, but when we hear that the cost could be on par with two world wars and the Great Depression, what does that mean in terms of what we would witness tangibly and how would it affect our lives?
Climate change is going to mean more wildfires, more droughts, more heat waves, more floods, more extreme weather events, higher insurance claims for weather-related damage, more rapidly rising sea level. All of these things are being accelerated by global climate change. The interesting thing about the report is, in my mind, that they said so emphatically that the costs of taking evasive action are likely to be very much smaller than the costs of allowing climate change to proceed unabated.
Well, one of the reasons that the Kyoto Protocol was ratified by so many countries is that the country saw the prospects of what's potentially going to happen and what's happening, in fact, right now. The problem is that many of the countries, and this is from the United Nations report that was released today, many of the countries that ratified Kyoto are not living up to their obligations. They were supposed to be cutting their emissions of greenhouse gases well below 1990 levels, but we know that emissions from Spain are up something like 49%, and Portugal, Canada, Greece also well behind their commitments under Kyoto. So if Kyoto isn't working, then what will?
The poor performance against the Kyoto targets is a reflection of one of the weaknesses in the Kyoto Protocol, which is that the focus was perhaps too much on targets and timetables and too little on the mechanisms for actually getting there. What we need in order to get there is a price on greenhouse gas emissions. People have to pay for putting greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere in order to generate an incentive not to do it.
The United States, as you well know, you worked for the Clinton administration, it has refused to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. So how likely do you believe it is that America will sign on to a future treaty that forces the United States to cut its use of fossil fuels?
I think the United States is going to transition from being a laggard to being a leader in this problem. I think the next administration in the United States in 2008, whether it's Democratic or Republican, is overwhelmingly likely to finally take climate change seriously and embrace a national policy with mandatory economy-wide reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. The leading Republican candidates understand this. The leading Democratic candidates understand it. I think it's going to happen with the next presidential election.
Kind of an unusual voice of optimism on the global warming front. What gives you that sense of positive action on the part of the United States?
Well, there's really been a sea change in the United States over the past few years. You have some of the largest and most influential corporations in the United States, General Electric, DuPont, Exelon, Synergy, calling for a mandatory economy-wide approach to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. You have 90% of the public roughly believing that climate change is real and humans are responsible for a substantial part of it. I think that view is increasingly propagating across party lines in the United States, and that the polarization that has impeded us in the past is going to go away.
Okay, Dr. Holdren, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Holdren is president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Some local politicians in London have a plan to tackle harmful emissions in their own neighborhood. They've got a plan to dramatically increase parking fees for residents who drive SUVs. The World's Rob Hugh Jones has more from the British capital.
Richmond in southwest London attracts wealthy, successful residents. Mick Jagger has a house here. Judy Parker has been a resident for nearly 35 years.
Richmond is a very affluent area, predominantly middle class, very beautiful. We have the River Thames, we have Richmond Park, which is absolutely glorious. You can walk along the river and there's lots of green open places around here.
But that green image of Richmond is under threat. The borough now has one of the highest CO2 emission rates of any borough in the whole of the London area. Judy Parker blames it on Richmond having a lot of gas-guzzling SUVs.
In my road, we have the Mercedes equivalent, the Volvo, the Porsche, the BMW, and, you know, the normal sort of Japanese ones. It's amazing. Just amazing. It's an age group, I think. It's mostly 35 to 45s. Well, that's my opinion.
It's this age group, young professionals and their families, that local council leader Serge Lowry is targeting.
We're hoping to introduce a sliding scale of charges for people parking in controlled parking zones. So if you have a small car, if you've got a G-Wiz, for example, an electric car, you'll pay nothing. If you've got a small car, you might go down by 50%. But if you've got a large car, we'll be charging you significantly more.
And that means if Lowry's plans get the go-ahead, SUV drivers will pay nearly $600 a year for parking their cars. That's three times what they pay now. Council leader Lowry says the policy makes good environmental sense.
What we really want to do is to change people's behaviour, get them to buy smaller cars, to trade down. We reckon that if everyone goes down one grade of car in the, you know, the sizes of cars, we'll save 15% on carbon emissions, which I think is really worth aiming for.
But some people are aiming at Lowry's plan, like local opposition councillor Nicholas Drew.
The headline is good, but the real story below is that Serge is taking £1 million tax increase out of local families and local businesses. If you actually try to introduce these things and tax people to the gills at the same time, you will not get public consent.
But that all depends on which members of the public you speak to.
I think it's very harsh to penalise people who've got SUVs.
SUV driver Carl O'Reilly is against the idea.
It does smack of playing to, you know, popular opinion, and it's targeting quite a small part of society, and that part of society is already bearing a large weight of the tax bill anyway.
Caroline Banks agrees. Walking along Richmond's busy main street, pushing a stroller and with two toddlers in tow, she says she needs her SUV to transport her kids.
Great for the kids, they're nice and high, you feel safe.
But Tony Wilkins disagrees. He says his kids never needed to be moved around in an SUV.
You can get three children across the back of a Mini, and I did. So, no, I don't have a great deal of sympathy for that.
Local celebrity Bamber Gascoigne, who used to be a famous TV host in the UK, says he's already changed his behaviour. He's downsized to an electric car.
I'm all for this scheme, and I think it's a sort of direction everyone's going to have to go, and Richmond is the leader and everyone else will follow.
For The World, I'm Rob Hugh-Jones, Richmond in London.
The Canadian province of Ontario is hoping to be a leader when it comes to developing alternative sources of energy. Ontario has a new program. It encourages small-scale alternative energy projects. The experts are calling it the most progressive in North America. The World's technology correspondent Jason Margolis has more.
The province of Ontario is roughly twice the size of Texas. 5 years ago, Ontario had exactly one commercial wind turbine. This left many Canadian environmentalists frustrated and scratching their heads. After all, countries like Germany and Spain were building wind turbines all over their landscape. Glenn Estel points out that until recently, tiny Denmark produced the fourth most wind power in the world.
Denmark's a three-hour train ride from one side to the other. They get 20% of their power from wind. I mean, if Denmark has, 40% of what all of the U.S. has, and, oh, by the way, four times what Canada has, it says something about, which policy gets you to where you want to be.
In Denmark, many of the wind turbines are built by small farmers and cooperatives. In North America, wind farms tend to be controlled by large corporations. Estel decided that if the Europeans could do it, well, then he could do it too. 6 years ago, he quit his job as computer wholesaler and set out to build a 225-foot wind turbine. Now he's got three, in the middle of a barley field about 4 hours' drive from Toronto. On a breezy day, the massive blades swoosh through the air.
I compare it to the sound of waves on a beach, only more regular. And of course, people pay a lot more to get the cottage near the beach, so...
But getting the turbines built wasn't exactly easy. Estel had to raise close to $9 million from investors. He also had to conduct wind studies and have the towers and blades shipped from Denmark. He says it was a bureaucratic nightmare to get the project approved by the government in the first place.
My bid was 11 pounds of paper, so it's a pretty significant bidding process. and that is very much built in favor of the large guys.
But now, the government of Ontario is adopting a new, simpler system. Dwight Duncan is Ontario's energy minister.
It's designed to encourage farmers, small community groups, to bring onto the grid small amounts of electricity that will help us in the long term deal with supply issues and bring on cleaner sources of energy as well.
In other words, the Ontario Power Authority will pay a premium for renewable energy and then make that energy available to consumers. The prices paid to small energy producers are locked in for 20 years. This provides some predictability and stability for people building wind turbines or putting up solar panels. One caveat, though, these projects must remain small, a maximum of 10 megawatts. That's enough power for about 3,000 homes. Duncan says keeping it small adds a new mix to the power grid.
You know, our whole electricity culture here is oriented to large generation projects with large transmission systems. We're not oriented to this, and so we're going to have to look at our experience going forward. We have to maximize all of these sources of power, the cleaner, greener ones. We have a goal as a government of closing all of our coal plants, and in order to do that, we need alternative energy, and this is one additional source.
The program has its critics. Some say it's too expensive compared with existing conventional power sources like gas or coal plants. Still, the Ontario government says it wants 10% of its power to come from renewable energy within 4 years. That'd be more than doubling what they currently produce. The government expects that most of that increase will come from wind power. Steve Clemmer says it can be done.
It's really not a technical issue, it's more of an economic issue.
Clemmer is the research director for the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Energy Program. He says the cost of building wind turbines has dropped in recent years, as traditional energy costs have gone up. Clemmer praises the new Ontario program for encouraging small energy producers. But he says that will only go so far.
I think we're going to see more individuals and groups of individuals like farmers putting up wind projects, but I would have to say that I think the vast majority of the development is still going to be from large-scale developers, and there's a couple reasons for that.
Clemmer says it's expensive to build wind turbines, and it takes a kind of expertise that large energy producers already have. And small producers are much more vulnerable to risk. Just ask Bob MacArthur. He's got a small wind tower in his front yard in Lion's Head, Ontario.
Too bad it's not flying. It was this morning a bit, but need a little more wind.
MacArthur is trying to power his house while recouping his investment, but he's discovered that success depends on one key element.
As long as there's wind, it runs well.
For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Ontario, Canada.
For more information about wind energy in Ontario, go to theworld.org. You can also find a BBC animated demonstration charting the course of global warming there. That's at theworld.org.
That's the sound of Buddhist Monks from the CD The Buddhist Monks by Sakya Tashi Ling. I think it's a pretty interesting sound. I like it. Only one more story for you this week. Like I said, it's a shorter podcast. If you don't like it, please send any complaints to my colleague Alex Galifant. If you have any positive comments, you can send those directly to me. Okay, the last story. I'm sorry about that. I just couldn't resist the sound effect. That, of course, is a coffee machine. Now, in biblical times, there was an expression. They said, turn your swords into plowshares. We've all heard that before. But in Ethiopia, a tradesman is bringing the saying into the 21st century. Literally. One man is turning burnt-out ammunition into coffee machines. Most of the shells are left over from the Ethiopian-Eritrean War. BBC correspondent Amber Henshaw went to the north of Ethiopia, and she filed this story.
Yeah. This is 55-year-old Asmara Zekele's workshop in Mekele in northern Ethiopia. It's here that he converts burnt-out mortar shells into the cylinders of the coffee machines. The workshop itself is made up of three quite small ramshackle rooms that lead from one to the other. Sunlight comes through the gaps in the corrugated roof, but every room is a hive of activity for Asmaro and his six staff.
The shells were dropped in Ethiopia during the war with Eritrea. They were dropped so people hid them in their homes, and now they sell them.
Mekele is about 200 kilometres from the Ethiopian border with Eritrea. Most of the old mortar shells Mr. Asmara uses come from the conflict between the two countries. They stand about 3 feet high. He cuts off the pointed ends, seals them, and puts holes into the aluminium cylinder. The cylinder channels the water, coffee, and milk. He explains how he got the idea 9 years ago.
When I was doing maintenance work, I saw some shells which people were selling, so I studied them. The shells were being sold for a different purpose. They were used for washing clothes or crushing things. After studying them, I came up with the idea of using them as a cylinder for a coffee machine.
Coffee is a major export from here and plays a big role in Ethiopian life. After meals, the traditional coffee ceremony allows family and friends to get together to share news and discuss the issues of the day. Coffee shops are also popular. This cafe bought one of Mr. Asmara's machines a few months ago.
Do you want coffee?
Yes, please. Yes.
Coffee? My machine.
I can see it.
This one is the Asmara.
Yeah, it's got your blue sign on the side, hasn't it?
It's a boy.
I had one other imported machine, but this one is much better. It's relatively cheap, the price is fair, and the machine is good, and it makes good coffee.
Cafe owner Haile Abraha is definitely a convert, but Mr. Asmara says it can be difficult to convince people to buy the machines because of the mortar shell.
These shells have all been used. We all need peace and we don't want war, but once these shells have been used, we should use our skills to do something with them. Sometimes I think about the fact they were used for war, but I want to change them to do something good. They could be a symbol of war, but I'm doing something good out of the bad.
Since he started production 5 or 6 years ago, Mr. Asmara has sold hundreds of machines. He can't remember exactly how many. Each one costs $1,300. Most of them have been sold to people around Mekele. In the future, he hopes to sell them more further afield, maybe even to coffee shops and restaurants in Eritrea.
That's all for this week from the World Studio. Thanks again for all your helpful and positive emails. A quick shout out to Jackson Griffiths, who is listening to the podcast in the Czech Republic. He says, regards to you from your biggest podcast fan in Central Europe. Regards to you, Jackson. Regards to you. We'll see you again in a week. Thanks for listening.
See your reflection in the still shallow pond. Remember back to the old days, to the days lost and gone. Tomorrow marks a new day, and the chance to break free. Never mind.